The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the April 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News called Addressing Learning Loss in Disadvantaged Kids. School leaders with hundreds of billions of dollars in federal COVID-19 aid are ramping up plans to offer summer school and tutoring programs in an effort to recoup learning losses. By Lauren Camera, April 8, 2022. Students with disabilities, those learning English, and students who live in rural communities learn at the same rate during the academic year, and often faster, than their peers who are not disadvantaged. But they lose much more ground over the summer, according to new research from the Nonprofit Education Policy and Assessment Organization, NWEA. The finding bolsters calls by Education Secretary Miguel Cardona for state education officials and school leaders to offer intensive summer learning programs for students who have incurred the steepest academic losses due to chronic interruptions to learning during the pandemic. Historically underserved students can grow academically at the same pace or faster than their peers in the school year, says Lindsay Dworkin, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at NWEA. Prior to this research, it's been unclear what the school year versus summer growth trajectories have been and where we are losing ground. This research puts a big spotlight on summer and the need to do better over the summer for these students. While education policymakers and school districts have a solid grasp of the setbacks experienced by students of color, less research exists on how learning interruptions have dwarfed the academic achievements of students with disabilities, those still learning English, and students from rural communities. The new research from NWEA uses data available on the learning loss that these groups of students experienced during summer breaks prior to the pandemic to extrapolate what pandemic-related learning loss might look like for them. Its researchers also analyzed the learning patterns of each student subgroup to better understand where and when they fall behind. For example, in a study of K-8 students nationwide, rural students entered kindergarten with higher achievement levels in math and reading than their non-rural peers. But by the end of third grade, non-rural students consistently outperformed those from rural communities across the grades. The report found that rural students grow at slightly faster rates in math and reading than other students when school is in session, but they lose more ground almost every summer. For students with disabilities, a study of K-4 students nationwide shows that they enter kindergarten behind their peers in reading and math, but go on to make gains at similar or higher rates than their peers during some school years. The group's biggest challenge is that they lose more ground every summer, which has contributed and compounded to widening disparities in achievement. Another research study that focused on achievement and growth for English learners in K-4 showed that they had lower test scores than their peers through their elementary school years, but that they also made academic growth similar to or at greater levels. However, similarly to students with disabilities, students who are still learning English tend to lose more ground over the summer than their non-English learning peers. Now, as a third year of pandemic schooling begins to wind down, school leaders empowered by hundreds of billions of dollars in federal COVID-19 aid are ramping up plans to offer summer school and tutoring programs in an effort to recoup some of those learning losses. There are plenty of resources, Dworkin says, and to the extent that money can solve the problem, and there are no easy answers, there are a lot of federal recovery resources at the disposal of districts and states to move heaven and earth to make this possible. An early analysis of how school districts are spending the federal aid from the American Rescue Plan from Future Ed, an education policy organization housed in Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, shows that roughly 30% of the funding is going toward academic recovery. According to the analysis, schools have spent more than $1.7 billion in one-time funding for tutoring and coaching, a sum that is projected to grow to $3.6 billion by the time federal coronavirus relief aid to education expires in 2024. But a whole host of difficulties stand in the way of getting such services to students, even among the most well-laid plans, including staffing shortages, teacher burnout, transportation challenges, and the voluntary nature of the programs that make enrolling students difficult. In Newark, for example, where roughly 45% of the district's 38,000 children have a first language other than English, including 10% of K-12 students who do not speak English well, according to federal data, and where 9% of students have a disability, the results from mid-year assessments are alarming. Education officials expect just 6% of students in grades 3 through 7 to reach proficiency on end-of-year state math tests based on those mid-year assessments, compared to 27% who met proficiency prior to the pandemic in 2019. Students are staring down a similar fate with reading, with 10% students in grades 1 through 7 expected to reach proficiency. Like many urban school districts with a growing population of English learners and students with disabilities, Newark has struggled to hire enough specialized teachers and is still contending with major disruptions, including as recently as January, when the district was forced to pivot to remote learning during the surge in the Omicron variant. And according to district data, more than 35% of students were chronically absent in February, another pandemic-related setback with which many city school systems are contending. With the $282 million Newark will receive in federal pandemic aid, education officials plan to expand summer school and tutoring programs and hire additional teaching specialists to work one-on-one with students, which Cardona has asked all school districts to prioritize. But as it stands, Newark is making after-school tutoring and summer school optional, relying on students to opt into them rather than incorporating them into the school year as a requirement for all students. Some education policy experts say that while the intent is good, and to some extent districts can't adopt such requirements due to staffing challenges or union contracts, the voluntary nature of the academic enrichment programs means many students will miss out. A recent analysis of its after-school programs by Chalkbeat found that the district only served 3,800 elementary school students per day, or about 16% of those children. And while some schools also offer tutoring during the day, the analysis concluded that it was unclear whether the offering qualified as the high-dosage tutoring that Cardona has called for and research shows is most effective, like programs that include multiple small group sessions per week. This information demonstrates that our system is effective at educating our students during the school year, and it is a call to action for states and districts on how to target summer programming so that all students can excel in school and beyond, Deborah Delisle, CEO of All for Ed and former Education Department official during the Obama administration, says of the NWEA report. Our children deserve nothing less. But even programs specifically designed for students with disabilities or those still learning English are running into uptake problems. In New York City, where former Mayor Bill de Blasio directed $200 million in July for every school to establish a special education recovery program that offers after-school and Saturday services, including intensive tutoring and speech and physical therapy sessions, many schools didn't get those programs up and running until December, and some lasted just 10 weeks. Staffing challenges and lack of bus transportation further crippled participation. While city officials have said the programs are open to all of the city's 192,000 students with disabilities, they also expect just 35% of them to participate. What's unclear and concerning to school leaders based on early evidence from school systems like Newark and New York is how impactful and long-lasting the programs those dollars are supporting will be. A powerhouse of K-12 leaders and policy experts, led by Kevin Huffman, the former Tennessee Commissioner of Education, and Janice Jackson, the former Chief Executive Officer of the Chicago Public Schools, announced earlier this week that they're closing in on their goal to raise $100 million to address that very problem by scaling cost-effective yet impactful tutoring models they hope to embed in schools for the long haul. The evidence is clear, Cardona said earlier this week. High-impact tutoring works, and I've urged our nation's schools to provide every student who is struggling with extended access to an effective tutor. We must seize this moment to use federal relief funds to help students, including those most impacted by the pandemic, to close gaps in opportunity and achievement that grew even wider over the last 2 years, he said. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's called Help Wanted, Adjunct Professor Must Have Doctorate, Salary $0. After protests, UCLA took down a job posting that offered no pay. But it turns out colleges often expect PhDs to work for free. By Anna Mona Hartikalis. Published April 6, 2022. The job posting for an assistant adjunct professor at the University of California, Los Angeles set high expectations for candidates. A PhD in chemistry or biochemistry, a strong teaching record at the college level, and 3 to 5 letters of recommendation. But there was a catch. The job would be on a without salary basis, as the posting phrased it. Just to be clear, it hammered home the point. Applicants must understand there will be no compensation for this position. The posting last month caused an immediate uproar among academics across the country, who accused the university of exploiting already undervalued adjunct professors and suggested this would never happen in other occupations. Under pressure, UCLA apologized and withdrew the posting, but the unspoken secret had been fleetingly exposed. Free labor is a fact of academic life. These arrangements are common in academia, Bill Kislyak, a spokesman for UCLA, told Inside Higher Ed when at first defending the job posting. Contingent faculty, the umbrella term for all kinds of generally part-time and untenured college teachers without much, if any, job security, make up a huge portion of the teaching staff of universities. By some estimates, around 70% overall and more in community colleges. They have long complained about the long hours and low pay, but these unpaid arrangements are perhaps the most concrete example of the unequal power in a weak labor market, in which hundreds of candidates might apply for one position. Institutions are able to persuade or cajole people who have invested at least 5 or 6 years in earning a PhD to work for free, even though, academics said, these jobs rarely lead to a tenure-track position. If your theory is that associations with UCLA is itself compensation, then it makes sense, said Trent McDonald, a PhD candidate in English and American Literature and union organizer at Washington University in St. Louis. I think there is the belief that you can eat prestige. Very often, adjuncts and other contingent faculty are asked to do unpaid work that is presented not as free labor, but as a way to hone their own credentials, according to union activists and some instructors who have received such requests. It may be characterized as professional development or service. Professionals are sometimes willing to teach a class in their field for free so they can put the university affiliation on their business cards, said Joe T. Berry, a former adjunct and historian of contingent faculty. And the instructors who are pressed into teaching without job security are often women or minorities who began entering academia in force as the system was shifting to contingent faculty, said Dr. Berry, who recently co-wrote a book on the subject called Power Despite Precarity. In a previous book, Dr. Berry said he has a page listing all the terms that have been used for contingent faculty. One of them is, quote, uncompensated. The union representing contingent faculty at the University of California has been fighting the uncompensated positions for years, said Mia McIver, the president of the union, which represents about 7,000 members. The fact that it is common does not excuse it, she said. The union suspects that the number of uncompensated teachers at the university is increasing, said Dr. McIver, who is also a lecturer in the UCLA writing program. As of March 2019, we had identified 26 faculty members at UCLA alone, she said. In the California system, the trend seemed to have begun with the financial crisis of 2008, Dr. McIver said. By 2010, she said, we became aware of people who had been laid off and who were teaching for free in the hopes, without any commitment from the university, that if the work came back, they would be hired back to teach for pay. The union won a settlement with the administration in 2016 requiring compensation for lecturers, who are mostly part-time and make up a majority of contingent faculty, Dr. McIver said. But while lecturers are now unionized, adjuncts are not, allowing the university to have adjunct positions known as, quote, 0% appointments, meaning that they are unpaid. A spokesman for UCLA, Steve Retea, said that before the settlement, the people who taught for free were often full-time professionals with other income. He said he could not comment on the number of 0% appointments without seeing the documents the union was relying on. But he said that a typical example of a 0% adjunct is a tenured professor at another institution who has a formal affiliation with UCLA that might include mentoring students or serving on committees, or someone who has moved to another university but wants to finish out a grant or a project. The job posting, quote, regrettably contained errors and a lack of context, he said, adding, we always offer compensation for classroom teaching. Even if someone takes a 0% position willingly, the union sees it as a disincentive for the university to create more secure positions. From my perspective, it doesn't matter whether someone had another job or another position, or is a retired professor who wanted to come back and teach, or a refugee scholar who needed a position, or a postdoc doing research who wanted or needed to teach, Dr. McIver said, rattling off possible justifications. Ultimately, all of that doesn't matter because anyone who teaches at a university or any school, let alone the University of California, should be paid for their labor. Liza Loza, a graduate student in molecular microbiology and microbial pathogenesis at Washington University, was excited to be asked to teach a discussion section about 4 years ago. She had to do a lot of preparation, spending hours reading very dense scientific papers and anticipating students' questions. But she saw the job as her chance to make those discussions more hospitable to women and other students who had been shut out of the hard sciences. She remembered her own experience having professors who were so intimidating that she was afraid to speak, and she wanted to set a counterexample. She was told that the job was unpaid because it was a professional development opportunity. She says the experience was valuable. I did get a lot out of it on my CV, but also personally, as something that I wanted to help make better about the program, she said. Then last semester, in her third year of teaching the section, she found out by accident that graduate students in other departments were being paid $1,000 for the same work. That was, for me, a bright line, she said. It just seemed sort of straightforwardly unfair once I figured that out. She wonders if she was lulled into working for free by the culture of academia, which drills into everyone that they are lucky to be there. It is a privilege, she said. A spokeswoman for Washington University, Joni Westerhaus, said graduate students in Ms. Loza's department were required to have one, quote, mentor teaching experience for which they were paid through their stipend. She said they were not considered contingent faculty. Ms. Loza said she continued to teach beyond the requirement and was not compensated for it, while others were. In an indication of how widespread the practice of free teaching may be, the Twitter posts reacting to the UCLA job posting included one Caitlin DeAngelis, a historian, in 2018, while being paid to work as a research associate on a project about the historical connections between Harvard and slavery, she said that she voluntarily taught a course called Harvard and Slavery, normally taught by a tenured professor. She did so because she cared so deeply about the subject. The course was an extra responsibility added on as a lectureship in the history department that did not come with additional pay, she said in a text message. On Twitter, she expressed some regrets about agreeing to teach without salary. In retrospect, she wrote, I shouldn't have done it for $0, but I wanted to get the info out to students. Harvard confirmed that Dr. DeAngelis had an unpaid lectureship in the fall of 2018. Lynn Carey Mehta is a longtime lecturer at Barnard and says she has seen a devaluation, even though adjuncts often have similar credentials to tenured professors. When I first started, we were called instructor and then lecturer, she said. The title changed to adjunct instructor, adjunct lecturer, almost aggressively, as if trying to put us in our place. Dr. Mehta, who has a PhD in comparative literature from Columbia, has spent a career as a part-time worker because she needed the flexibility to care for her husband. She said that unionization at Barnard had provided increased job security through multi-year contracts and higher salaries per course. Of the UCLA job posting, she said, quote, "It's insulting." The next article comes from Education Week, and it's called, "To Support Stressed Staff Members, Districts Are Turning to an Overlooked Resource," by Denisa R. Superville, posted on April 12, 2022. Employee assistance programs, which offer staffers help with mental health, financial, substance abuse, family care, and other issues, have long been a staple of school district benefit packages. Now, with the pandemic taking a toll on the well-being of principals, teachers, and other K-12 staff, some districts are seeing an increase in the number of employees using those programs, which typically cover dependents and household members as well. But even in the districts that have seen some growth, officials worry that employees may not be fully taking advantage of EAPs, which in pre-pandemic times were often used to support the disciplinary process and may carry a stigma. Some who oversee EAP programs now wonder whether EAPs need to rebrand to meet the current needs of district staff and whether districts should step up efforts to bring the programs to employees. Howard E. Fields, an assistant superintendent of human resources in the Kirkwood School District in suburban St. Louis County, Missouri, acknowledged the lingering stigma around mental health in general and in how EAPs were used pre-pandemic, mainly as a part of a compliance process. EAP does need a new brand, he said. There's a subsection called Looking for Ways to Increase Appeal and Usage. The Columbus, Ohio School District saw the untapped potential of EAPs and rebranded its program even before the pandemic. One of the biggest changes was incorporating the program into the school system's existing wellness initiatives to help reduce the stigma around accessing the EAP and to increase participation. The term EAP isn't used as much anymore. The school system also got a new outside service provider and found additional and more convenient ways for teachers, principals, and others to access the services. Rather than waiting on the phone to schedule an appointment or meet with a counselor, for example, staffers can now get help via live online chat or by email. They can still meet with counselors in person. The district also added TalkSpace, the online counseling app, which allows users to chat or text with a licensed therapist around their schedules. When you're dealing with a high-stress situation, just waiting on hold can be daunting, said Courtney Hale, the director of Total Rewards, the name for Columbus's wellness and benefits program. The district also added programs aimed at stressors that can trigger anxiety, such as financial wellness. It communicated the additional resources through its wellness website, newsletters, e-blasts, and webinars led by its new service provider, Hale said. Part of the impetus for the rebranding and increased communication was to ensure that employees knew that the district supported their overall well-being, said Michael DeFabo, the district's chief talent officer. For example, if an employee receives a cancer diagnosis, counseling through the EAP program can help manage the clinical diagnosis as well as the reverberations that follow, Hale said. When DeFabo arrived in Columbus in 2019, the EAP program was still very much a transaction, he said. It was very much structured around someone has an issue, we deal with an issue, we move to the next issue, he said. We are trying to get away from that and really focus on what is important to an employee when they come to work. Hale's position was once known as the Director of Human Resources Administration. Now it's the Director of Total Rewards, focused on employee wellness and satisfaction. This was a program that was kind of in the closet as something that we needed to check off, but we didn't really do a good job of promoting it, putting it out there for our employees to know that it was there, Hale said. After the rebranding, EAP utilization nearly tripled, from about 10% in 2020 to 27% by the end of 2021, a period that coincided with the most intense part of the pandemic. Among requests for clinical support, the increase came in categories such as emotional assistance, stress, occupational help, and relationships and families, DeFabo said. Of the 2,080 staff interactions with district-offered EAP services from July 1 to December 31, 2021, about a quarter were from staff members seeking help with emotional issues, nearly double over the last 2 years, according to DeFabo. 11% were stress-related, and 10% were work-related. I think that makes a lot of sense. We are dealing with a lot of things differently, DeFabo said. It's a lot of stress, and people need support in figuring out how to navigate those feelings. Hale and DeFabo are aiming to have utilization reach 40 or 50%. And we'll cut that article short for time. The next article comes from U.S. News, and it's called Cardona Reaches Out to Florida LGBT Youth, Warns GOP Against Restrictive Laws. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona traveled to Orlando to speak with LGBT students and families and warned conservative states he's prepared to investigate them for restrictive laws. By Lauren Camera, posted March 31, 2022. 10-year-old Dempsey Jara, a transgender girl who lives just south of Orlando in Florida's Osceola County, loves to run. She's the fastest girl on her school's cross-country team, according to her. But next year, when she starts sixth grade and moves up to a new middle school, she may be forced to run on the boys' team. I want to run on the girls' team because I'm a girl, she says, and I don't want to be on the boys' team because I'm not a boy. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law last year a bill that bars transgender females from play on sports teams, nominally because of a persistent belief that they have an unfair advantage. Earlier this week, Arizona and Oklahoma became the third and fourth states to do the same. I don't understand it at all, Dempsey says. I'm just trying to be myself and live my life and be a kid. Meanwhile, Dempsey's mom, an 11th grade history teacher, is focused on the Sunshine State's more recent efforts to curb the rights of LGBTQ students, namely the controversial new law dubbed the, quote, Don't Say Gay Bill, which prohibits classroom instruction of sexual orientation and gender identity for students in kindergarten through third grade. The legislation is touted by conservatives as a parental rights bill and an antidote to what they view as a public school system that shut them out. The problem I'm having is that not only am I Dempsey's mom and her cheerleader, I'm a teacher, says Jamie Jara. I have a trans kiddo in my class who isn't supported at home, so the only time she hears her pronouns is in my classroom when her name is being called. When we start taking away these safe spaces, a lot of kids say school is the only safe space they have. Jara says the grade span that the new law covers are the 3 years it took for Dempsey to socially transition. What would I do if this law had been in place, Jara asks. Hide her? She was growing out her hair. The kids had questions. Jara and Dempsey met Thursday morning with Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, who traveled to Orlando to speak with students and families on Transgender Day of Visibility. He warned conservative states adopting laws that restrict the rights of LGBTQ students and their families that he's prepared to use his authority to investigate them. We have the Office for Civil Rights, and at this point the office is designed to make sure the civil rights of students are being protected, Cardona said. So if, in the implementation, we receive requests for investigations, we will thoroughly investigate. Cardona said his warning isn't restricted to Florida and that other states that pass similar legislation targeting LGBTQ children and their families will be investigated if his agency is asked to do so. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.